Okay, we'll call the meeting to order of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, and welcome all today to another presentation of matters of issue to us here and to the people of Minnesota. And so, first item, we have a quorum, so we'll go ahead and just do the minutes. And I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative McElfatrick moves the minutes. On any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to a vote. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. And on to our agenda. Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, you have your bill on the agenda today, House File 2348.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2348 for possible inclusion in the omnibus that we hope to have, possibly.
All right. Thank you.
The topic is, this is actually a little half a page worth of language, but the impact of this could be great. In Washington State, we'll hear some more about that, but the state of Washington spent 3 years devising a way to decide the value of the work they were doing. We have fiscal notes in our committees, and the word dynamic is not a word we use to describe those. They're actually kind of narrowly focused on what's going to cost today, and if we put a cost off till tomorrow that maybe not even included, or some other unrelated, some other tangentially related part of government's not included. What this would do would be to look at every project we do in the human service world and corrections and some other ones probably, to see what the value is and to see if indeed there's a return on investment. And is it, many programs we think we're going to do some tremendous good. We get a bill, we get a study going, we spend $10,000, and at the end we spend $10,000 of nothing to show for it. That would be a bad return. Maybe we spend $10,000 and get $100,000 worth of value to show for it in all the savings. That'd be nice to know. And so people from both sides of the aisle, from middle and left and right, argue about why are we doing this stuff? And I think if we could actually get some way to score it and to have a truly dynamic impact in the state about these projects, we could then actually agree that some things are tremendous and some things really don't make much sense, really. And so the current method is that you have a strong author who still likes it after 10 years being in office, and you can't kill the thing. It hasn't done any good since the first person got helped, which is why it was devised. And it goes on and on. And some projects that really should be used that would be far more beneficial never get off the ground for reasons they don't have a good enough author, or there's not enough money that particular day and that year in the budget when actually the payoff would be tremendous and the savings would be remarkable. So the idea of this bill specifically is to appropriate $100,000 to put into a fund that would set up the framework of this with more work to come back to get it going. And I would rather just start it and get it funded and put it in the base. I was advised that was a little optimistic. So I'll turn over to my witness to talk about more detail, but that's the idea of it. And when I first heard about it, I thought, we're onto something. An analytical tool that is apartisan and agnostic on anything except for value and or devalue. So with that, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, sorry, I'll invite you to call upon my witness.
Thank you very much, Representative Abler. And welcome to the committee. And again, for the tape and for the record, just state your name and your title, and please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Westcott, and I'm here as really a citizen for a small group.
I apologize, Mr. Westcott. Could you have the microphone as close as you can, and even if you move over a little bit to be directly in front so we can hear you clearly? Thank you.
Thank you. I got my blocking set now. Okay. So, Kelly Harder and a group called a group of us together of concerned citizens, really, and we worked in various levels of government. There were people from the state, and there were people from county and other people, and I had been retired for a short period of time, to get together and talk about the return on investment. It's been a model that's been around for quite some time, whether in the state of Washington or in Canada or Great Britain. It's been used often. And what we talk about it when we talk about it, it is just one more tool that we can put in the toolbox of state government than really to apply to make more informed decisions and really to heighten the transparency of decision-making that we do. So what does it really mean? It's really applied economics, and it's really moving practice into the economic world. I could bore everyone with regression analyses and other things, but I'm not going to. It is an economic tool that demonstrates or compares economic and social value. I think that's an important thing, both economics and social value, of benefits of programs and policies and with their associated costs. As Representative Abler talked about, OLA reports, for example, are post-audit reports. So it tells us how we spent our money and things. But and then fiscal notes also tell how much money we're going to spend in state government. It doesn't apply all the money that is going to also be spent at the county level and other outside forces as we move into the situation. So it's a cost and benefit analysis, but you've got to go beyond that from the economics into the social values of that. So how does it work? Excuse me. You measure the total cost of resources used by the program to produce its outcomes, which is important. Measuring or defining outcomes is important, a step of it. You enumerate and measure the outcomes. You assign a monetary value to the outcomes, and you compare the benefits and the costs with that. Again, the state of Washington has been doing this for quite some period of time. I would say the two major tenets or underlying principles that why it works in the state of Washington, it's independent, it's perceived as independent, and they're very rigorous in their application of the cost of the return on investment models. And it's not used for everything, but it's used in some social service programs and some corrections programs. And what else do I want to say? Again, I would say just one more tool for the toolbox. There's other ways to get to good governance and transparency, but whether it be through competitive contracting or prevention or collaboration, but I'll stop at that point.
Thank you very much, Mr. Westcott. And Representative Abler, are there any other testifiers or anybody else here today that it might be in the audience that would like to...
You could call for them. That's all we have.
Okay. Is there anybody at all? Okay. Seeing none, members, questions? Okay. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think this is a great way for us to start to broaden the discussion with people who aren't on this committee, who sometimes don't understand what we do and who have stereotypes about its impact. And I think it can be a great way to, in a credible way, independent of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health, you know, have that dialogue about what our investments coming back at. I should note that as one of the co-chairs of the Redesign Caucus with Representatives Carol McFarlane, Representative Erdahl, and Representative Marcourt, we have actually been in discussions about doing an even bigger sort of state approach like Washington has done, and are beginning discussions with the Pew Foundation, who's maybe interested in helping fund it. So there may be some opportunities there as well. But what I like about this proposal is it's looking at our existing programs and the full spectrum of people that we serve. There have been other proposals to do research on human service programs that are only related to a small investment to a targeted little group. Like, you know, last year there was the discussion of doing appropriation bonds, and investors would reap the return from that public investment. And I think this kind of helps us address the bigger pictures and the larger investment that we have in human services. So I think it has some real promise.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Any other members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Abler, I also think this has some promise. My one question, though, would be whether you've talked to MMB. Is this something they think they can reasonably take on? Is this the right place for this to be housed?
Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, actually, I have not talked to them. If they were giving them some money, and now we're having a hearing, I figure they'll be letting us know what they think. It's being held over, and I would think this would be, it's very compatible with what they're trying to do, and I think it's friendly. So hopefully if they were reticent, perhaps you can invite your friends there to listen a little carefully to Representative Loeffler's excitement about it. So, but I don't know yet.
Yes, Representative Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Loplin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Abler. To that point, I should just note that this is a great place to start the dialogue. Our understanding from the Redesign Caucus is that there's actually an assistant commissioner in the Department of Administration who's kind of their point person on these kind of things. The Department of Administration has always had kind of a management analysis, sort of a lot of analytical type staff who'd look at work with state agencies on these sorts of things. And so, you know, I'm sure that we'll have an opportunity before your bill is finalized, if this is a component, to try and figure out where that is. And I'm sure you'll get advice from the administration. But there are actually people in state government who have been engaged in some of these discussions, and it could go in either one, I suspect.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
And there's a not that I want to always be known for the person who has flexible language, but I'm not tied to any word in this draft here. And my interest in bringing forward a draft was to push the start button. When I heard about this and saw the rigorousness of the Washington model and their oversight, we're frustrated in this committee. We know we want to do something, you know, and or our predecessor has set up a project. And it's a cute project, or it's a really good project, or it's a necessary, we better keep doing this forever project. And we can't always tell the difference. And we just don't like it. It doesn't appeal to me on something, so it doesn't get in the bill, and it was an error that I left it out. Or it was an error to put it in. So that's what I'm hoping. And so if people have advice about how to better design it, who should be the lead here, I'm very open to that.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Chairwoman, excuse me. I don't like a lot of hyperbole and praise, but Representative Abler, I must say that after knowing you for 2 years, you're a man of great conviction and diligence, and I've often heard you say that you don't like studies just for the study's sake, and there's a whole Indiana Jones kind of warehouse full of these studies, and the taxpayers are probably sick of spending money on studies and nothing becomes of it. So I am confident, and I want to add some hyperbole or some praise, that this is very important, and you know what you're doing, and there will have some great outcomes because of this study, and I think it is great use of taxpayers' dollars for this study, because I'm confident that with it, you and the staff and those of us around the table will use it to the best of our abilities to provide the best health care at the best cost for the best Minnesota. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. And I was going to mention that I appreciate Representative Abler, I do think that the legislators, we don't claim to have all that knowledge, and we appreciate others contributing, private citizens as well as other entities. But I do appreciate the fact that you have included in here that legislative staff, counties, institutes of higher education, and other stakeholders, and I think maybe a little bit more of what those other stakeholders, especially since it's a return on taxpayers' investment, that those folks who are put in the bill for that would be included in some, because I see a lot of government entities here, but I think also approaching, and they have a lot of knowledge as well. So it sounds like there's some good energy going here, and I know that's being laid over, so we can all contribute to that further effort. Ms. Representative Abler, did you want to?
So are we done? Well, I appreciate your interest in this. And I hope we can find the money to do this, and maybe we can even do it for less. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And with that, the motion to lay it over on the table for possible inclusion is considered. Thank you.
Whoops, and Kiffmeyer, I think your bill is going to go to the General Register. So if you want to make that motion, that would be great.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I make the motion that House File 2348 be recommended to be passed and to be referred to the General Register.
Well, go ahead. You can welcome to the committee. You're already here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to be welcomed. Appreciate that very much. On House file today, the bill that is in front of us, I do have some testifiers, and there are quite a few items on the agenda already for our testifiers. And Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate their opportunity to have ample time here for them to speak to this issue. But in particular, this is not new to this committee. The rate equalization issue is not new. And what we have wanted to be very important here is that we preserve the access, we preserve the opportunity. But as we know, our nursing homes and long-term care facilities are very challenged in this environment and some of the situations that they've gone through to be able to continue to afford to provide the quality services that we have here in Minnesota. But what I've also tried to balance out with this bill is making sure that when you have a cost of providing a service and that cost is not currently being accommodated for, that those residents who are private pay be able to pay for the cost of their care. But in a way, in a gradual sort of way, since currently right now it is a position that is not the case. And so capping that and a gradual situation is protecting the private payers and preserving access to care for everybody. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to allow my testifiers to take their time to make their comments, if that's okay.
Well, thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Just to the general bill, this is the version that left in the conference committee. It's 2% a year. Indefinitely, right? Is that correct?
Up to the cost of pay.
Okay.
2%. A cost of...
It's 2% each year.
2% each year maximum.
Maximum.
Okay, thank you. Just to help people understand. So there have been different versions. This is the version that was in the in the omnibus bill that got vetoed by the governor for reasons. I'm sure this wasn't the reason, but so there were a lot of reasons that he vetoed that bill.
And Mr. Chairman, there is no fiscal note as well. There is no cost in this regard.
That one's been requested, and it came back at zero.
Zero, yes.
And members, there's a copy in there. I'm going to read it. So just to help that detail. So, Ms. Thurlow, welcome back to the committee. It's
been Thank a you, day Mr. Chair. Here, I think this is, what, the third time this week?
That's good to have you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota.
And I'm Heidi Holstein, representing Care Providers in Minnesota.
Together, we represent the long-term care imperative. By the time we get done with session, you'll be able to share our intro, do our intro for us, probably. So I'm going to kick off the presentation with the bill, and first want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for bringing forth House File 2374. As has already been said, this is not a new issue. We had quite a lengthy hearing on this last year, but a few things have changed, and so we'll try to focus on some areas of update for you as much as possible. I do want to highlight that this is a compromise bill. As Representative Abler pointed out, after a vigorous debate in the committee last year and a conference committee, this is the same language that was in the 2011 Health and Human Services omnibus budget bill that does allow an increase of private pay rates up to 2% above the medical assistance rate each year, and it's designed to balance a lot of the concerns that have been raised over the last few years. It's important to note that this is not a repeal of rate equalization entirely. It is a modification. And also importantly, I know an issue of importance to a lot of folks are anti-discrimination laws. We do nothing to repeal anti-discrimination laws in this statute. To that end, there will still be state and federal protections prohibiting discrimination on the basis of care source. I believe you have a handout that cites federal law 483.12C1 that is the equal access to quality care. But also, even in the remaining rate equalization law, and you can see the original language from the law on House File 2374, the remaining language in state law prohibiting discrimination remains intact on page 3, line 18, starting with facilities will be prohibited from discriminating against in admissions, services offered, or room assignment on the basis of payer source. And so I want to make that very clear that we are doing nothing to prohibit anti-discrimination and take that issue very seriously. As Representative Kiffmeyer pointed out, privately paying individuals are not currently paying the full cost of care. We've had tough budget times, and as a result, Nursing facility rates have largely been frozen over the last 4 years. With the repeal of rebasing last year, we actually don't have a mechanism in current law to increase nursing facility rates at this current time. Because medical assistant rates have been frozen due to the rate equalization law, so too have been private pay rates. And we have just gotten updated data at the end of 2011 that now estimates the gap between the actual cost of care in a nursing home and the medical assistance rate. That gap has now grown to $28 per resident per day. I believe last year at this time, I think it was around $25. And so costs continue to escalate, but we still have challenges with rates. These privately paying individuals are those individuals that could likely afford to cover their costs, actual costs of care, and this is just a mechanism to help nursing facilities allow some additional coverage of those costs. We've also argued to you before, and I'll just cover briefly, that we believe the rate equalization law does do some disservice in encouraging savings for long-term care. The message has been that clearly, people don't necessarily have to take responsibility to save for their long-term care needs, that regardless of payer source, they'll get to pay the exact same as the public assistance programs. And we believe removing the disincentive is a step towards long-term care financing reform and can help spark additional collaborative efforts to identify incentives to encourage individuals to plan for and save for their long-term care needs. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Heidi Holste to cover a couple of additional points.
So the point is that financial stress on nursing homes is increasing. Many of you know that because we've told you that the Medicare program does take care of some of the, does offset some of the funding shortfalls of Medicaid rates. According to a long-term care imperative survey that we conducted in early this year, the number one way that care centers have addressed shortfalls is by maximizing their Medicare Part A operations. However, last year, on October 1st, CMS actually decreased the rates for nursing homes by more than 11%, and further cuts are likely coming forward. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, four more nursing homes have closed in the past year, and this trend is continuing. Nursing homes will need additional funding to compete for labor and address staffing needs, but revenue sources are frozen or declining. Caregivers bear the burden of the underfunding. Over 70% of our costs are for wages and benefits. According to that same survey that I just mentioned, nearly 69% of nursing homes have frozen their caregiver base wages in the last year. 40% of nursing homes have reported that they have frozen employee base wages since 2009. In addition, many have actually passed on increasing costs of health insurance benefits to employees or completely eliminated health insurance benefits. And finally, underfunding of nursing facilities impacts in other ways. According to the survey I mentioned, care centers are making tough choices to address the shortfalls. They're delaying physical plant expenditures, reducing direct and non-direct staff hours, and reducing resident activities. Thank you for your time, and we're open to any questions.
I have one or two, and then maybe members do. $28 a day, what's the average day rate, 140 or 50 or so?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at
one. Maybe just the ballpark.
160.
So that's pushing 15, 20%, which is a lot. So I hope people understand that. That's significant. $25 number doesn't mean a lot without the context. And the Medicare piece, they rescued the provider, the doctor rates, but not the nursing home rates, out of that grand deal they made, right? Is that right,
Mr. Lowe? Chair, members of the committee, the 11% cut that we're referring to actually was not even done through an act of Congress. It was done through CMS. And there was no remedy in this last negotiated deal. There was no remedy from Congress. And, in fact, we are potentially looking at additional cuts to Medicare rates for nursing homes in the coming congressional session.
Really? And how do the Medicare rates compare to Medicaid? Are they 30% higher or something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're getting a signal that no, it's not quite that high. No, it's higher. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we're being told is that it's higher than 30%, but it pays for more services.
Okay, well, I don't think this is a finance committee, so we could tolerate the numbers, but I don't think we want to go there right now. But it just seems, just to help, I think, point out your concern and mine as well, that the clinics have more clout with Congress than nursing homes do, which I'm somewhat surprised about. And I think there's a 21% or 7% rate cut that keeps getting put off. Each time they put it off, it's a little bit more for the Medicare thing. That was part of the last deal, is they put it off until, what, Christmas, I think, or something. And the Medicare part, we have no control over. But most of the homes that have some Medicare mix actually make it. If you're all Medicaid, you're really in trouble trying to make it go. And that's correct. Okay. Any other questions from members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we need to get to witnesses and other topics here, but if we could get some information about, I don't understand, I'm learning still, a study of nursing home rates, but my understanding, at least in the hospital area, is that Medicare does cost reporting and cost analysis, and it's actually pretty sophisticated, and so they seem to have, and they're always lagged, so you're always behind. But if they do the same thing in the nursing home industry, I'd be interested in that because, you know, we've always, no matter who the provider group is in front of us, we always have this, whether it's the dentist, the physical therapist, you know, the group home. I mean, everybody says we're underpaying, but the doors stay open. And our ability to get to, you know, what does it really cost, what's going on, has always been challenging. And if we could better understand if you're treated the same as, like, hospitals in terms of the cost reporting and that kind of thing, or if you've got a whole, how does CMS give you 11% rate reduction? Is it based on that kind of analysis? Because you said it wasn't Congress. So I'm just trying to learn. And you don't need to take the committee time. But I think we're going to need to learn this more as we go into the future budgets because it's tricky.
Mr. Chair,
if somebody's here, we actually have time to hear that answer. I think it'd be interesting if somebody's here that wants to comment about that. We don't have
Mr. Chair, we
all
have
nursing home hearings.
We have Jeff Bostick, who's one of our guys that we call the data guys, who could probably provide a succinct answer.
Well, welcome to the data guy.
Thanks. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jeff Bostick with Aging Services of Minnesota, and I'll try to provide a fairly quick answer, and we can obviously get you some more information about the Medicare rates are established by CMS and directed by Congress, and there is cost reporting that's involved and analysis that's involved in setting those rates. MedPAC, if you're familiar with what that is, makes recommendations on what Congress and CMS should do with those rates. MedPAC tends to recommend that rates either be decreased or not increased from year to year, because from the federal perspective, they kind of have a reverse analysis of what we have at the state level. At the state level, we talk about how Medicaid rates are too low and we need Medicare to make up the difference. At the federal level, their analysis is that Medicare rates are too high for nursing homes and therefore they should reduce those rates because there's margin there. But when you put those two together, it basically balances out so the nursing homes are barely able to make it between the two programs. So there's a little tension between what states do with Medicaid and what the federal government does with Medicare. So when the federal government cuts Medicare and says that nursing homes can, afford to essentially eat an 11% cut without an increase in Medicaid rates, or in Minnesota where you can't increase private pay rates, you get a lot of squeeze on the revenue side, and that's going to trickle down to what happens to caregivers and residents ultimately. Does that help clarify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps just put it in context. Thank you for taking the time.
Other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And mine is more of a statement probably than a question. But it's triggered by the conversation that we had in committee on transparency in the health plans a couple of days ago, right? And so we're hearing from a variety of providers about payment and not being paid enough to meet costs, and we're hearing it from, practically everybody. And the one data point that I don't really have are what are the costs, right? I don't know what the costs are. And I don't know why some facilities do well and seem to be profitable and are making it and others are not. And I don't even know really which ones are doing well and which ones are not. So I am sympathetic to the providers and the institutions because I want to make sure the people getting care get their care. And I want it to be done well and high quality and safely. But it is hard to know with the bill like this if there are some nursing homes that are doing really well and this is just going to increase their bottom line and others are going to really need it. And I think for the ones that really need it, maybe we should do that focus, but I don't know how to judge that question. And so, you know, this is a impart a statement. If you have advice for me, that would be really helpful. But mostly, I think, to the committee, I think if we're going to go down this path of transparency and talk about provider payment, I mean, I think need more a more honest discussion about the costs underneath some of the institutions that we're in relationship with to understand our decision-making better.
Yeah, Mr. Murphy, I think on this niche, I think the costs are pretty heavily reported compared to other areas where they're not. There's no black boxes. There's no bottom in this box. I think, is what they're, but maybe one of you two would like to. You want to?
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand there's no black box,
yeah.
Right? But there also seems to be a lot of conversation about providers being underpaid, and a lot of facilities that just keep plowing forward.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do one of you two want to offer some thoughts and?
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'll defer to Mr. Bostic if he's got details. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, certainly the financial stability of nursing homes varies greatly. And their ability to stay open and remain viable are dependent on a lot of different reasons. This last survey that we did of nursing homes, the number one way, and we've known this for some time, the number one way that they've stayed open, you've heard this in the committee before, is maximizing Medicare. And I think one of the takeaways we hope you take away from today is that's no longer really as viable an option for financial stability as before. Another reason why nursing homes stay open is it's because they've diversified their operations and provided, you know, where they can, you know, offset their losses with other sorts of operations. They've spent down their reserves. And, you know, that's really how nursing homes are making it. It's not really some hidden sort of where they're hiding revenue. It really is that they are making do and they are running out of options. The only other thing I will say is that we know that about 75% of most nursing home costs, operating costs, are staff and wages. And that 40% of our nursing homes reported in this last survey that they've frozen employee wages and benefits since 2009. So that's the other way that they're making it. And, you know, we can provide, you're right, the costs, nursing home cost reports are transparent. We report almost everything to DHS, and Jeff can go into details about that, but there's no hidden revenue here. They're running out of options.
And actually, we have some department staff here if you want to talk about that. Maybe we should just have them come down since they came all this way. Mr. Tabella is here and Ms. Erber, and so maybe if you just want to come down and offer a comment about what sort of. I think it's a discussion. We've had this discussion about the details. Now we'll have some detail about this, and there's still plenty of time for all the witnesses. Welcome to the committee. And I think the question we're looking for is. Why do some make it and some don't? What do they tell you? And that's a start. So, okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Tavell from the Department of Human Services. The nursing facilities do give us a cost report every year. It shows all their costs of operations. And we have been looking at that. We also get their revenue information on it. And we have been looking at the past 3 years of that to try to put together some sort of picture of the health of the industry. We haven't released any of that information to anybody. We're still going through some of it and looking for making sure it looks reasonable and asking providers different questions about the information we're seeing. So that's why we haven't given that to anybody yet. But it is showing something of what you've heard earlier is that if you look at the MA rate, it does not meet the cost of services. The number thrown out was $25 a day and then later $28. I know that in 2008 we looked at it, it was approximately $25 a day. However, something that's just the MA rate. There are other revenues that nursing facilities get through the state and through their residents for other things, such as they can charge more for a single bedroom, they get additional payments for the first 30 days of a resident's stay, they get bed hold payments when a person goes in the hospital. So there are other things that are not included in that deficit of $25 a day. So is there any other specific questions?
Professor Murphy, I kind of brought them there for these discussions. So well, what else do you want to know? Well, this is a good time for it. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll follow up with you. Some of the nursing homes, I think, in the state are profitable. Others are struggling. And I'm not sure that this is the right solution. I'm trying to figure that out. And I don't really know. I don't know. But I do want to be clear before I give up the mic and turn this over in response to Ms. Thurlow's comments that I'm not talking about hidden revenue. I'm not talking about any malfeasance. That's not my concern. I just think it is hard. We hear all the time about payments not meeting costs, and it's a really hard question to judge.
And Mr. Thank you. Fair enough. And I'll ask a question. Mr. Tabell, since can you just give me an example of a kind of a standard nursing home that's about to fail and what that would look like, what demographics they have, and another example of a standard nursing home that's in the mid-range and they're still hanging on, maybe even offering benefits to their staff?
Mr. Chair, the facilities that we've notice that kind of stand out that we've looked at, which is not too surprising, is that for-profit nursing facilities generally do better than not-for-profit or the governmently run facilities. It stands to reason that a company that's in the business to make money does so. The government facilities, many of them have are attached to a hospital. And the reason that their numbers look so bleak is mainly because they have a lot of hospital-attached costs allocated to them. So it kind of skews the picture in that their costs look heavier because they pick up a share of hospital expenses. Facilities that have closed in the recent years, I can think of a couple that closed. They were governmental or hospital attached, and they decided they didn't want to be in the nursing facility business anymore. There were some others that closed. We don't know why. They just decided they didn't want to provide nursing facility services anymore, and I know some of them did convert to assisted living facilities.
Well, thanks. And have any gone out of business just because they couldn't make it anymore in your lately or anything?
I'm not, Mr. Chair, I'm not recalling any that have gone out of business simply because they ran out of money. Bankruptcy, there have been some facilities that have gone through bankruptcy in the past 5 years or so, but they've come out and they are still open.
Okay, Mr. Bostick, do you know of any that have closed because they went out of business because they were because of rate issues and all?
I mean, the reasons for closure are kind of varied and complex, but I think that financial pressures are almost always to some extent a factor in the decision to no longer operate. I mean, if I were going to give a profile of the 60 plus facilities that have closed over the last 12 years or so, a lot of them are older buildings. They're in markets that just aren't as good for nursing facility services. They're not able to compete for the Medicare business. Like we were saying, there's a lot of desire to have as much Medicare business as you can get. The MA rates, like we were saying, are short of the cost of care. So if your primary business is MA, you're going to need to be able to do some Medicare or do some some of the private rooms, some of the things Greg was talking about to bring in additional revenue. And people have found in some cases, for example, some of the smaller town facilities that have closed, they really wanted to, a lot of the operators really wanted to keep those open, but they just weren't able to make it go financially. So.
Well, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Boy, this is starting to get really intriguing.
We're doing math in the math to me.
I'm really grateful to Representative Murphy for framing this issue so well, because I've been struggling with the same thing and really not being so clear about what the real problem is here. And I just wanted to ask the witness from DHS, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name. What was it?
Greg Tabell.
Tabell. Okay. Well, Mr. Tabell, I have a couple questions for you. First of all, I thought I heard you make the statement that the for-profit nursing homes are doing better because they're for-profit, which is, that's just astounding to me. I guess I'd like to know how you can do better and take a profit out when you're, you know, how does that work? What's behind that, if that is indeed true? And the second thing I really wanted to ask you is, you referred to some data that's being collected, and I want to ask you, you know, when can we get that? Because I'd sure like to see if you're working on a report with this, you know, maybe you could tell us a little more about that, when it'll be available to us.
Mr. Tabell.
Mr. Chair, the first question regarding the profitability, my statement was simply, our initial reaction to the data is the for-profit ones generally do better. And it's just our rational thinking that if you're in the business for profit, then you're more motivated to make profit. That was what my statement meant. We didn't take a survey or anything like that and ask these providers, you know, what's more important to you, making money or providing care. We didn't do anything like that. It's just our reasoning that if that's your business, then you're going to try to make a profit. I can tell you that generally those facilities, the reason they do better is because their costs are lower. They watch their expenses better. Currently, rate setting is not tied to operating costs except for a few facilities that are in what's called the ECPN program. Those are governmentally owned facilities that are allowed to get their full costs recognized in their rate. The non-for-profit and the for-profits are not in that program. So if you can lower your costs, it does not drive your rate down. The question about when the data will be available, I don't have a date for you. We've been looking at it for some time now. What we want to make sure is we've got it right before we release it. There were some questions that we came up with as we looked at the data saying, you know, this just doesn't look right. We went back to some of the providers that, you know, we're looking at this. This is what we're seeing. Can you explain this? And some people said, oh, well, there's a mistake in our data, so we went and corrected those mistakes. We're still going through that process, and that's why we haven't released it yet.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, that's good. I guess I would encourage you to get that to us as soon as you can. And, you know, we're used to the fact that data isn't perfect. We're really used to that, in fact, in this committee. But nevertheless, I think that would be very important for us to have. Also, nobody's mentioned anything about, I don't think, I haven't heard anything about the regional variation in payments. Does that, you know, going back to Representative Murphy's question, does that have any impact? I haven't heard that it does. Did I miss something there?
Mr. Bostic or Tabell, whichever. You can both answer, maybe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, regional differences, we haven't noticed that any particular region is any better or any worse off. We tried to find some correlation behind those that do better than others or those that do worse than others, and we haven't really come up with anything to explain it other than the for-profits do much better than the nonprofits, and the nonprofits do better than the government.
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks. On the question of regional differences, I would agree in our look we find that there's quite a bit of variability in overall financial performance, which we look at every year for the long-term care imperative throughout the state. And I would say it's varied a little bit, but in general, you know, operating margins come in at, you know, maybe 0 to 2% as an average, and that includes people who are doing better than that and people who are doing worse than that. And there are people who are doing better and worse in every area of the state. Again, it comes back to the factors that we talked about here. The Medicaid rates are frozen, so that's kind of a known quantity right now in terms of how much revenue you have from that program, which is, you know, two-thirds, in a lot of cases, two-thirds of your days on average over 60%. So it's a question of how much Medicare business that is and how there is and how much other revenue you're able to access. So to bring it back to the bill here, the, you know, the 2% that we're looking for on the private pay side is not going to make a huge, you know, overall difference in the amount of revenue that's available. But it's at least something for facilities who otherwise are not going to, you know, have access to additional revenue this year, and it's going to mean, you know, increases for some caregivers who otherwise aren't going to see increases and haven't seen increases in the last few years.
Thank you. Is that good? Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My godmother and one of my favorite aunts, Aunt Abby McDonald, was administrator for the Elam Home Nursing Home in Watertown for many years. A lot of my family worked there, so I'm quite familiar with this topic and what the law has done, unfortunately, to our local nursing homes. So I support the bill and believe it to be very, very important, especially for Greater Minnesota nursing homes who are desperate financially and unsustainable. And the question I have is regarding some research in front of me. It says that in cases where the rate charged to private pay residents is less than the medical assistant rates for certain services, the medical assistant rate is made equal to the private pay rate. So one could deduce that although that may be good for the nursing home, an opportunity for them to make up what was lost because of this law, is not necessarily good for the taxpayers. Now, I just want maybe some clarification. Is this something that, of course, helps in the equalization with nursing homes, and perhaps that Carrie or Patty might be suitable to answer the question?
So, Ms. Thurlow, you want to? Thank you, Mr. Tabell. You can maybe just hang around a little bit there. I might be talking to you again. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I'm going to try to rephrase your question to make sure I'm answering it accurately. I believe that your question was, would we be open to a change to the particular bill to basically say that if the private pay rate was less than the medical assistance rate, that it should go down? Did I hear your question right? I'm sorry.
Representative McDonald.
No, that's all right, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. No, not necessarily. I'm not offering any suggestion to change the good bill of Representative Giffmeyer, not whatsoever. I just wanted to understand that in that particular case where some services could be less for the private payer, now the medical assistants are charged up to that level as well. So is it fair to say that because of this bill, rate equalization, because of the law rather, that some services are more for medical assistance when they could be lower to equal that of a private payer? Is that correct?
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, under current law, let me see if I can answer your question this way, and let's see if we can go from here. Under current law, nursing homes are, there are certain exceptions, but under current law, nursing homes are not allowed either to charge private pay residents less than the medical assistance rate. And we can talk about issues that's created also as well. And so I don't know if I'm getting at your question, but it does, the rate equalization law creates inflexibility in both directions. And so this particular proposal will allow some amount of flexibility. It doesn't undo all of it, but it takes us in the right direction.
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman, maybe House Research can answer this, or yourself, Representative Abler. I just want to understand, maybe I'm not being clear, in the research data that we have, it states that in cases where the rate charged to private pay residents is less than the medical assistant rate, the medical assistant rate is made equal to the private pay rate. So in that circumstance, doesn't the taxpayer have to pay more for a service where the nursing home was willing to charge less for a private payer? Is this an opportunity for them to make more? I just wanted to understand. Well, and I was hoping, Chairman, that to understand that perhaps this law that we currently is on the books is certainly even making it more worse for the nursing homes.
Maybe I'll phone our friend. Ms. Pinelli, do you want to take a run at this?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lowe has. I think we found it on the summary, and that might help to clarify what you're referencing. And she has a comment.
We're looking for help here. So yes. Anybody in the audience wanted to weigh in?
How many, Mark? How many phone calls do I have?
Yeah. So who's going to answer? Not Ms. Pinelli,
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We're conferring here.
Okay.
Jeff, I think that
that's fine. Take your time.
This is the sentence that he's reacting to. That it's the in practice.
It's nice we had time available for this. This is what the luxury of time. We get to discuss things.
Mr. Inquiries. Chair, Representative McDonald, if we could follow up with you and clarify, we will do so.
Ms. Pinelli, you want to give a run at it? I think you were ready to answer something, or are you just going to say ask somebody else?
Mr. Tabell might be able to answer better than I can, but I think in instances where the nursing home charges a private pay rate that is less than what the MA rate is set at, the MA rate is reduced down to that private pay rate. Yes.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I think the main thing is that they have to be the same. So if one is lower and the other is higher, whatever that might be, in the end they have to be the same, and there's no flexibility. Ms. Thurlow may have other.
Yes, no, that's correct.
That's that covered. There you go. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going back a little bit to what Representative Liebling was commenting on earlier, and just 2 points. We hear this sometimes in the healthcare circles, and it frustrates me a bit that we kind of castigate for-profit as if somehow that's greedy and underhanded and should, in fact, cost more, and that somehow not-for-profit confers some sort of kindness and benevolence and all this on people. And we've seen across the board in healthcare there are problems with for-profit as well as non-profit situations. So I don't know that non-profit or for-profit is the issue here. It may in fact be that for-profit people have to take a sharper approach to it, and I'm not here to criticize the nonprofits, but the assumption that, boy, something dirty must be going on if it's for-profit, I just want to call that out. I don't think that's the way we should approach it. Let's look at the facts. The second thing is, and the reason I've wrestled with this issue and come to support this bill, is we have created perverse incentives. We've created perverse incentives. In this society, we have created an incentive for people not to do for themselves and rely on public programs. We look at what's happening with medical assistance, and it's not getting us anywhere. We are constantly making bigger promises we can't keep with money we know we don't have, and even future generations don't have. And this is a problem. What's happening now in many cases is people, as they get old enough and need nursing home care, and I know there are people who aren't old who need nursing home care, they default to hiding or spending off their assets to go on medical assistance. And we get more and more and more people on a program that we can less and less afford. The state of Illinois is $8 billion behind on Medicaid payments right now. $8 billion. And if you go across the country, there are numerous other states that are falling on the same hard times. Congress is having to reconvene constantly to talk about how they bail out states on Medicaid because we're making these promises we can't keep. So here we are once again, we're limiting everybody to the same basic rate. And those who can afford, who can save up, who really maybe ought to be, maybe we've talked about this bipartisanly, that we need a new approach to long-term care. We need to start encouraging people to save up for or plan for the costs of their care in retirement. And yet we continue to do this thing where we have rate equalization and we force people down to the minimum. the Medicaid rates that providers already say are below their costs, we're forcing everybody to pay below cost. If you're a business, you can't do that. You simply can't do it, and we're doing it to our nursing homes. So I appreciate the effort to move us a little ways back, not eliminating it completely, but allowing nursing homes in an incremental way to move back towards saying, if you are able to save up, if you have the resources to pay for your care, we'd like you to do that. Because medical assistance funding should be saved for the people who absolutely can't afford it. And this is a big problem. It's a situation in the structure of our system that needs to change. This bill moves us a little ways back, because right now the people paying the price are our nursing homes. And by default, the people that they care for. So I'm enthusiastically in support of this reasonable measure. And beyond that, we really need to start addressing, how are we financing long-term care? And are we, in fact, facilitating people not planning for their long-term care costs if, in fact, they can? Again, medical assistance is for people who cannot. It is a safety net, not a catch-all. So I would encourage us to think about that. Think about it on this issue as well as other issues impacting long-term care. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that point?
Sure. And then we have Rustin Schumacher on this, but I think he'll be happy to yield for your response. Is that okay?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do agree with Representative Gottwell that there are perverse incentives, but I actually interpret it just the opposite, which is this will create an incentive for people not to save, because they are going to be punished for their savings by paying higher amounts than this government pays for the person next door to them in the nursing home. And I can tell you, I have had relatives who were in nursing homes before we did rate equalization, and proceed from generation to generation, right? And there was so much discussion when the family would get together about the family member who had to pay more than the other people in the nursing home, and they were getting the same care, but there wasn't a social worker coming in and making sure they got adequate quality, and how stupid they were that they were paying more money than the government was willing to pay for the exact same care, and they could have transferred their assets like so many other people. And so, I mean, I think you have to look at it. I think actually many people are uncomfortable about transferring their assets, but I think they will feel justified if they feel like they're going to be picking up not only the cost of their care but the underpayment of government. And I think the real solution is for us to find a way to be an adequate payer and pay a fair amount for the cost of the care of the people that we're responsible for, and to figure out ways to create that sense of personal responsibility so everybody feels like they're treated fairly and the fair prices is paid, so that the workers earn a fair living, that they have quality care, and that we have a system that we can all be proud of. But I think the incentives may actually work the other way, and I'm just don't want private payers to have to pick up shortfalls in government funding.
And actually, Representative Loeffler, I agree, except everywhere else in every other system. At the ER, there's some fool who's paying retail who doesn't have insurance, and then somebody has a Blue Cross plan that has a reduced rate, and somebody gets MA, and they're all three different prices. So I wish it was so simple. But Representative Gottwald, do you want to respond?
Well, Mr. Chair, just one more back and forth, perhaps. Representative Loeffler, you're absolutely right. But instead of focusing on the perverse incentives, we're using this crazy mechanism, blunt instrument of rate equalization. And you're right about the cost piece. But we don't focus on the cost of Medicaid and the real impact. To do what you just said, I would like you to put the numbers to that. If you want to adequately fund the generous Medicaid benefits package, how much would we have to raise taxes, and on who in this state and across the country to fund that the way you're describing? And then let's deal with that reality. But as far as the perverse incentives, you're right, and that's what we should focus on. Medicaid should differentiate so that people are truly tested on what they're able to pay. The idea that we're going to create perverse incentives is right to a certain extent, but then what we can do is work on changing that, changing Medicaid eligibility so that it goes to only the people who truly need it. The problem right now is we're using this blunt instrument to drive everybody down to the lowest common denominator, as if that's reality. It is not. There are people who can afford long-term care costs and should pay for it. There are other people who cannot and will not.
and who we should be helping through medical assistance. And so what we should focus on is differentiating between those two instead of forcing the nursing homes to pay through this blunt instrument of rate equalization. We haven't put any effort into that part. We just keep arguing about whether we should have it or not. And I think that's kind of a dead-end argument.
Well, Rep. Laffer, do you want to counter? Then we're going to go to Rep. Schumacher. Then we're going to take other witnesses.
But okay, Mr. Chair, I think we've had some important witnesses in the audience, and I do look at the time, and while it's been really generous to debate this, I think we'll have other opportunities. Thank you.
Okay, and then Rep. Schumacher, do you have a question for the witnesses? Go right ahead.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say to the back and forth that was here, it was really interesting. The Citizens League had a report in 2010 that was talking about the nursing home industry and how it costs us about $1 billion a year right now, and if we keep on the same track we are in the next 13 years, we're looking at about a $5 billion project. And so before I turn 40, we raise this industry by about 500%. And so there are some changes that need to be there, and I'm glad there was a discussion on that. I was also glad that Representative Loeffler mentioned the employees, because that's where I wanted to talk and had a few questions. Before, we were talking about what facilities had closed or not over the last little bit of time because of these things. But I was wondering what other measures might have been taken to prevent a closing for a facility that's just in a county or the only facility in town. And were those maybe towards employee hours or what other steps might have been taken? I know in my district, 2 of the 10 for sure have cut their hours in the last, month, I guess, to meet some of these things. And I was just wondering, besides closing, which is obviously the last step that they can do, what other measures do you see your facilities going to?
Ms. Thurlow, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, very briefly, in addition to reducing staff hours, in some cases, in a lot of cases, just freezing employee wages and benefits, cutting back on benefits, other thing that we've talked about today, other things that facilities tend to do, closure of vacant nursing facility beds. We've seen a dramatic reduction in bed capacity. tends to be another way to try to control costs. That tends to be the other way. You know, sometimes they'll shop around and try to see if there are other efficiencies they can make in collaborating with others, potential sales and whatnot. But I think what you see oftentimes is, in addition to sort of managing on the staff side, reducing beds is another very common way to do that.
Mr. Schumacher. Okay, let's move to the next list of witnesses, and so maybe if you can make some space there. So Mr. Varco and Ms. Kimball, do you want to come down? And then on deck we have Ms. Stone, Ms. Holtz, and Ms. Weeks. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Varco. I bet you thought you'd be up a little quicker than this, seeing where you were on the list, huh?
Well, and you've started in on much of my testimony, so some of this might be a little redundant, but I'll try to keep it relevant. Chairman Abler, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent about 15,000 healthcare workers around the state of Minnesota, including 3,500 nursing home workers. We are also a member of the Seniors and Workers Coalition, along with our friends in AARP and a lot of other groups. I'm here to oppose House File 2374. While our union would support almost any measure that would provide additional resources to care for our seniors and to pay workers, we cannot support this measure. But before I get into that, I'd like to thank the chair and the author for bringing forward the bill to at least start the discussion, which I think we spent a lot of time talking about the bipartisan consensus that we are not funding nursing homes adequately. I think there's been a lot of talk about that issue. Unfortunately, I don't think we've been talking about why this particular group of people should be required to pay more for nursing home care. Instead of rehashing previous testimony against earlier versions of this bill, I want to highlight some testimony that I heard last year, and I actually heard Ms. Thurlow reiterate. Supporters of this bill insist that modifying rate equalization will not cause public pay residents to get care that is lower quality than private payers. Every time a version of this bill is heard, you hear great assurances that nursing homes have no idea if a resident is public pay or private pay. Every time you are promised that no home would ever treat public pay residents anything less than equally. I disagree. We have members who worked in homes prior to the rate equalization law, and they disagree. The published study, Driven to Tiers, and that's T-I-E-R-S, disagrees and says that public pay residents around the country in states that don't have rate equalization laws receive worse care. But you don't have to take my word for it. Instead, trust the words of someone who testified last year in support of a similar bill and which Ms. Thurlow just reiterated. This is the testimony from Jim Burcham, who's the president of Elder Care Minnesota, which operates a nursing home in Greater Minnesota, last year to Representative Hamilton's bill. He said, and here I'm quoting, "It has been the state experience that the policy of equalization discourages saving for long-term care. The message to consumers has clearly been sent that, regardless of payment source, the exact same care and services will be made available to you, whether you are private pay or medical assistance. Okay, it is a good concept, but what happens is people then, this encourages transfers of assets to family members and general spend down of personal assets. Removing this disincentive is a step towards long-term care financing reform and can begin to encourage people to begin saving for their own long-term care needs." Mr. Burcham says equal treatment of public payers and private payers is a disincentive. Equal treatment is a disincentive we need to eliminate. According to Mr. Burcham, and it sounds like Ms. Thurlow, if private payers can expect to get better services, people will be more likely to save for long-term care. According to Mr. Burcham, we should repeal rate equalization so that private pay residents get better treatment, and thus people will have more incentive to save for long-term care. According to someone who testified in support of a bill like this, removing the rate equalization law will cause nursing homes to provide better pay for private pay residents. According to him, unequal treatment is not a potential side effect to be avoided. It's one of the central goals of legislation like this. Now, I disagree with the economics of this, and you've already started discussing that, I think. I think people save for long-term care almost entirely to avoid going into a nursing home. Nobody wants to go into a nursing home. You save money to keep yourself out of a nursing home. But that's beside the point, I think. I think it's wrong to treat residents unequally. Proponents of this bill, most of the time, in the start of their testimony, say it's wrong, too. But when you dig into the arguments in favor of it, at least some of the time, they agree that this bill will lead to unequal treatment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe we'll take all the testifiers and then we'll come back to more discussion at about 2:12 we're going to vote, so we can just 2:12 just to give time to vote and then say goodbye. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Michelle Kimball. I'm the director of AARP here in Minnesota, and I represent roughly 700,000 consumers over the age of 50 in the state of Minnesota. I am here today to register AARP's strong opposition to House File 2374. We believe that this proposal will force nursing home residents who pay their own way to pay more, resulting in a significant cost shift, in reality a tax on people who did the right thing and saved their entire lives and now pay for their own care out of pocket. And under this bill, nursing homes would be able to charge private pay residents 2% more each year without any guarantee of better quality. Last fall, AARP released our first ever long-term care services and support scorecard, and it revealed that nursing home care is not affordable for middle-class families in our state. And in fact, the study showed on average that the cost of a single bedroom is roughly $75,000 each year. This is more than twice as much as the typical household income for a person over the age of 65. And even with rate equalization, Minnesota ranks only 21st among the states regarding nursing home affordability. The repeal of rate equalization will no doubt make it much more difficult for private pay residents to pay their own way as long as possible without having to rely on government dollars. In fact, the large monetary shift that would result from repealing rate equalization would not only cost individuals thousands of dollars more per year, but we believe it will, in fact, cost the state more in the long run. Increasing costs to private pay residents does mean that they will spend down sooner and go on Medicaid sooner. So while the AARP scorecard did rank Minnesota 21st in affordability, it also revealed that Minnesota ranks number one overall in terms of quality. This is in nursing homes specifically. This is no doubt something we can really be proud of, and we believe rate equalization is actually a contributing factor to that. Before the law passed, many people on public programs often did not have equal entry to nursing home beds, and the care they received was often of poor quality than those who paid privately. We are concerned, as my predecessor just mentioned, that repealing this law will recreate the financial incentives to discriminate and could, in fact, result again in a two-tiered system of health care. Finally, we know that you have been working hard to minimize cuts to nursing homes, and we really do support these efforts. However, repealing rate equalization does not ensure fiscal stability for nursing homes, nor does it address the budget issues facing facilities that have a majority of ME residents. And in fact, in other states without rate equalization, nursing homes are still lobbying their legislators for more money. Finally, I want to address an important issue that Representative Gottwell just raised, and that is the important issue of personal responsibility and planning for long-term care needs. That is absolutely something that AARP strongly believes in. And to that end, we are about to launch a major education campaign in the state of Minnesota to engage individuals of all ages to plan ahead, much like they do for their retirement, for their long-term care needs, and to save appropriately to pay privately for long-term care. And in fact, again, as Mr. Barco mentioned, most people do not want to go into a nursing home if they need long-term care. And an AARP survey that was done in the state of Minnesota repeatedly for a number of years between 2003 and 2009 indicated that 97% of those in the state of Minnesota, if they need long-term care, would prefer to stay in their homes and communities. So having said this, AARP does urge you to reject repeal of rate equalization and to maintain what we currently have as we work to address the bigger, more systemic problems that we have in our long-term care system through long-term care redesign, much of which we are undertaking as I speak. So with that, I would like to ask for your courtesy in listening to one of our terrific volunteers who knows what it was like in nursing homes prior to rate equalization being passed.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Christine Stone, and I'm a volunteer for AARP for the last 25 years as an advocate. I'm 92 years old, and some of you may recognize me as I've been around many times in the past lobbying on health care and long-term care issues. I'm here today to speak again against repealing the rate equalization. I really do not think this bill is fair for seniors who have tried to save their entire lives. My husband and I lived frugally our whole lives. I would like to be able to pay my own care if I should need it, but when you allow nursing homes to charge me more, I worry that my money will not last as long, and then maybe I too will end up on Medicaid. Do you really think this is right? Should I be penalized for living frugally and saving money? My years of experience have led me to believe that the nursing home rate equalization law has helped to improve nursing home care in Minnesota. Before I moved to Minnesota, I lived in Texas. In Texas, the difference in nursing home care between my sister-in-law, who was paying privately, and her brother, who was on medical assistance, was like daylight and dark. After suffering a massive stroke in 1983, my sister-in-law, who was a private pay patient, was in a new wing of the nursing home. Her brother, who was on Medicaid, was in the older wing of the nursing home. Her room was bright and airy, and she had many staff to attend all her needs, whereas his room was dark and dingy, and the care was very poor. Through the years, I've visited other family members in Texas and in Arkansas nursing homes, and in both states, the care for Medicaid patients are on a very different level to the private pay patients. Just 3 years ago, we visited a relative whose brother was in a nursing home, and his sister was so sad that she couldn't bring him home because the care was so bad. This law has ensured that all people are treated with dignity regardless of whether they pay privately or own a government program. I've spent a lot of time in the past 15 years visiting friends in Minnesota nursing homes, and I've been impressed that the care has been the same at the level for all patients in all those nursing homes. So let's not go back to a time where it will be difficult for all residents to get equally good health care. Thank you, and please do not take away a law that is doing the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. I remember you when you were here when I was a freshman 14 years ago. So I know you've been around a while, so nice to have you here. Ms. Do you want to ask her a question? At the end, okay. Ms. Holtz, and then we have Stacey Weeks. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I want to be Miss Stone when I grow up.
Don't we all?
I was really impressed with you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Deb Holtz. I'm the State Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. First of all, I want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for bringing forward this discussion and all of you. These are really hard discussions, and I had prepared testimony, but I'm going to speak more from my heart because many of your comments have caused me to think about different things, especially Representative Murphy. I think she raises some of the best questions and challenges for us today. We need to look a little closer at the cost. One of the things that I want to tell you about is what happens in the assisted living world that we have concerns about happening in the nursing facility world. Right now, you do have federal laws and state laws that prevent discrimination. I wish that they were followed and I wish they were enforced, but we see discrimination all the time. That's why we have an ombudsman office and in every state in the country. In the assisted living world, you already have a two-tiered system, which my brother, who's a small business owner, would say, that makes complete sense, Deb. But you have a system in the assisted living world where, first of all, Representative Murphy's comments are so applicable. People often do not know what they are paying for. They enter that system, they have saved all of their lives, but there may be fees, additional surcharges they're not aware of, or they live longer than they had planned for and they simply run out, they end up on Medicaid. When they end up on Medicaid, there is a two-tiered system. We see people that are moved to smaller settings, often having to live with one other adult, two other adults. Sometimes we've even seen that adults have to live with three other adults because they are now on Medicaid. We also see people evicted. So what I worry about with this discussion is that we haven't looked fully at the cost. I agree, we need a solution to this. The solution is not to adjust a Medicaid program that is at fault with not paying rates that people need and nursing facilities need, is not to shift it onto seniors and younger people with disabilities who need the long-term care. All of us may need that tomorrow. All of us could need it tonight if something happens to us. We don't know. There's no guarantees in lives. But we need to look at the cost and what actually happens to people. We have fears that you will create a two-tiered system in the nursing home world like you currently already have in Minnesota in the assisted living world. Caregivers don't want that. Consumers don't want that. Advocates don't want that. Legislators don't want that. Thank you for allowing me to have comments.
Well, thank you, Ms. Holtz, and it's not to the point of the bill, but is there evidence that, or are there instances where people are doubled up and hourly waiver payments?
Oh, absolutely.
Do we allow that?
Sure. Yeah. There are no laws preventing people once they are put on Medicaid and get the customized living payments that they have to have a single room. So you have, I think of my father who is almost 80 and he has saved all of his life. And fortunately or unfortunately, he's a very, very strong German. He will live to be 99. I can predict it. So if he has an accident or a stroke or anything happens in the next year and he needs long-term care and we have to look at an assisted living situation, which is where he'd want to go to first, or even a nursing facility, and I have no idea if his savings will last till he's 99, but if he's in an assisted living setting with my mother and then he ends up on Medicaid, he could be placed in another room. We've had situations where people are in rooms and their only privacy is divided by a curtain. We have those cases in our office. And I want to reiterate that the majority of providers in Minnesota do not do that. I always add this when I'm speaking in public. The majority of providers in Minnesota are excellent, and this doesn't happen intentionally, but it happens as a result of lower payments. It's a two-tiered system. Discrimination is happening all the time out there in the assisted living world because we have no laws to prevent that.
Thanks. I want to follow up on that.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
Not right now, but
yep.
And we have one more witness, Ms. Weeks. Hi, you may just slide in there somehow. And then I have two questions and maybe more. So we'll, three questions. Okay. Welcome to the committee. And you have the privilege of being the last witness, at least for now. So how about that?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Stacey Weeks. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and I'm here on behalf of Legal Aid and the Senior Law Project. We recognize this is a very tough issue. Today, there's been a lot of spirited debate on it. I think what I can add to this conversation is the legal reality that we see for our clients. And we really want to urge you to keep in mind the impact of these decisions that they will have on people, real people, and our clients. The legal reality that we see makes a lot of these fears that you've heard today real. We do believe that this bill, even if it's not intentional, it will lead to harmful consequences for our clients. It gives a direct financial incentive to discriminate against residents based on the ability to pay. Even if it's not malicious, it does give that incentive. And yes, there are these anti-discrimination laws, but these laws are really just remedies. They don't actually prevent or set up any barriers to prevent discrimination. Just like anti-speeding laws don't actually prevent people from speeding, anti-discrimination laws don't prevent people from discriminating. That's why we have speed bumps and signage. And I think, I know it's a crude analogy, but this rate equalization is a good example of a speed bump or signage. It's a protection that we have in the law. It's one of our best legal tools to prevent discrimination. And that's why we really do oppose this bill today. And we know that unequal treatment does happen. It's unfortunate. We have these cases. We see people that have gone homeless because they've been locked out. We've seen people end up in hospitals, which costs our state more money. It's a sad reality. And so we do understand that there is an issue here, some financial drain, some serious issues for the nursing homes. We just don't think this bill should be the answer. We think maybe we should challenge ourselves to find a better answer. And so I just want to encourage you not to shift this burden on our most vulnerable residents in our state. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to all of the testifiers again for bringing this opposition to this. And I too am continue to stay and am strongly opposed to this. This is not the answer. This is the needs of the folks in these nursing homes. I have in my years 35 working in the nursing home. I was there before rate equalization, and we had four people in rooms then. Then we got them down to three. Then we built on and we made one room per person. They were the private pay rooms. They still are. As soon as you run out of money, the very day you're moved, I've seen people lose their farms, their homes, their savings, and that continues to happen. Myself, 67 years old, I have a little savings. My home is paid for. I have some property. Should I have insurance? However, if I should end up in the nursing home or the hospital in the nursing home this week, I'll be broke in a year. There's no way that I can afford to pay this kind of money, and I think I've been responsible. It is a huge part of our health care bill, the expense that we have with our elderly population, but this tiny bit of money is not going to solve any of that. And when we look at the rates that I've been here 7 years now trying to increase the rates, bringing it in at 10, 7, 5, 3, 2, and 1, settling for none, here we still are looking at another way to find a little bit of money to do an impossible job. But what this little bit of money will do will discriminate. It will not help the problem. It'll exacerbate the problem. So I also, stand very strong against this legislation. And I ask also, before we raise the rates on our private pay people, for a roll call. Thank you.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested. You'll have one. You've been nothing but consistent on this topic, Representative Fitch. No one wonders what you believe on this topic. Representative Hosh, I wonder what you think on this topic. I think you've been also consistent, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, this is a frustrating issue for me, and this is why I'm frustrated is because this is an issue of this legislature's making. We do not fund nursing homes adequately. And if we say, well, this law is bad because we pay $28 a day less than what the cost is, we need to look at ourselves. And you know, we are right now choosing between two bad options. And I think as a state, we have an absolute commitment, and I would say a moral commitment to serving our elderly and those who are most vulnerable, especially once they can't afford that level of care. But the arguments of both sides are legitimate on this issue. They really are, and they're legitimate because we haven't done the job as a legislature. At this point, there needs to be a few things done to this bill to, I think, make it a little better. I'm going to support the bill today. But if the bill gets to the floor under its current form, I can't support it. For one, if we're going to make an argument that we want workers to be able to see the benefit of any potential increase, we should have an encumbrance in this bill, just like we have an encumbrance in the Medicaid rate, and make sure that a nursing home worker gets a certain percentage of whatever rate increase that a private pay resident is going to have. That absolutely should be in the bill. Two is, if we're concerned about disparities in how people are going to be treated, we should revisit this issue a few years down the road, because right now this could go into perpetuity, two-year increase every single year, and I think it would only make our jobs easier to ignore increasing Medicaid rates. We should have a sunset in this bill that will force us to reevaluate things, to see what's happened, and to see if this legislature has done anything in increasing Medicaid rates. So I hope that the author can consider those type of things. I'm going to give my support today to see if I can play a role in trying to find something that might be able to be implemented. But just because of my support of this bill doesn't mean that there isn't a lot more that we need to do as a legislature. We need to fund our nursing homes better. We have dramatically failed in that. So I hope we don't have to deal with this issue again. I hope we have a spreadsheet line down the road where we, instead of having a cut, we have an increase.
I share your interest in that. We'll be voting in 6 minutes. Representative Gottwald and Slawik and whoever else signs up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Representative Hosh for his comments. I think this is a nonpartisan issue and something we are all concerned about. But the question at the end of the day is whether we're adequately funding Medicaid and whether we're sentencing everybody to a public program rate, or a public program, if you will, or whether, in fact, we want to start encouraging people to private pay, and private pay adequately. At the end of the day, the people bearing the brunt of this are our nursing homes. You're absolutely right, Representative Posh. Whether we think we're adequately funding Medicaid or not encouraging the private sector to adequately fund their own care needs enough, as I said before, Medicaid is for people who cannot afford it. It is a safety net program. It is meant to be there for people who cannot do for themselves. And instead, through this program, we have disingenuously, I would say, and I would agree it's the legislature's fault, said that we're going to make everybody drop down to that level as a means of somehow equalizing care and pay. And in the end, we're underpaying our nursing homes, and I would argue that we're sentencing people to substandard care because they're going to start losing nursing home care. And nursing homes are not going to be able to provide the care that we need long term. More and more of us are aging every day, and more of us are going to live longer as we age. And as a society, we have to come to grips with the total cost of that. And whether that's by completely funding a Medicaid program, as I mentioned to Representative Loeffler earlier, put the dollars to that and ask yourself, does it make sense for government to fund that? Or do we need to partner more with the private sector, with people capable of planning early, maybe at my age or earlier, maybe at Representative Hosh's age? We need to start setting aside money so that we don't keep putting people on these expensive government programs, and the costs really end up getting shifted to future generations. You and I aren't going to end up paying for it. Our kids are, with deficit spending, money we don't have. And I just think we need to think very clearly about, do we want more and more people moved onto a Medicaid program we cannot afford to fund fully long-term, or try to somehow give people a sense of responsibility for beginning to save for their own care, now and in the long term. Because those costs are not going down, they're going up. And the ability for government and taxpayers to continue funding it through the Medicaid program is getting really tough. So I acknowledge there are good points to be made on both sides, but we've got to start having that policy discussion and respond to it more responsibly than rate equalization.
Thank you. Representative Slavik and then Representative Kiffmeyer can sum up and then we'll vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I have to say that Christine Stone is from Maplewood, the great city of Maplewood. And she is our hero in Maplewood, and she's one of my personal heroes. She has been a great mentor to me. We have talked on the phone many times, and I know it hasn't always been easy for her. So we really appreciate you coming down today. I've been in the legislature, you know, 7 terms now, 14 years, and I think we've been arguing this, all 14 of them. And here we go again. It wasn't a good idea 14 years ago, and it's not a good idea now. I think that there are real funding issues, obviously, that we're struggling with and in this committee in many, many ways. But I think that this would potentially, as we have heard, set up this two-tier system that would really hurt the folks that do not have the means. So I think this is not the right thing to do. I think, Mr. Chair, we're still going to continue to struggle with this, as we are with a lot of our health and human services. But I will be voting no today. I think this is an idea that's time has not come.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And it is a good discussion. And I think all your points are very valid and well made. What I'm doing here today is taking a start, because I believe that people who receive care should pay the cost of care. And we can't fix the government side of it right now, because we don't have any money to fix it. But the one thing we can do is that on the private pay side, I think most any private pay person would say, yes, I should pay my fair share. I should pay that cost of care. And I think that's what this bill is intending to do. It helps nursing homes because it enables a private pay to pay their responsibility to pay that cost of care and to get a start at doing that while the rest of government and other venues such as Representative Gutwald has mentioned and others as well have talked about. But this is an urgent need right now, and this at least fixes the private pay side of paying the appropriate cost of care. By the way, I know you'll find this hard to believe, but the rate equalization was passed after I was born. And matter of fact, I worked my way through high school. I had to work my way through high school and through nursing school by working in a nursing home. It was one of my great treasured memories of doing that. And I remember that was before rate equalization. There was no knowledge of who was on what program whatsoever. We took care of people. And that's a Minnesota tradition and a Minnesota value, not Texas maybe, but it is Minnesota. And I'm confident that by helping to correct this issue of properly paying for the cost of care, starting on the private side, will be constructive for our nursing homes in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I ask for your vote for this bill. Thank you.
And members, it's 212, not 1212. I want to, Mr. Poindexter has joined us today in the absence of Mr. Lear, so we're glad for that. So the new guy will take the role.
Chair Ebler.
Aye.
Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Anderson.
Yes.
Branson.
Aye.
Fritz.
No.
Gutwald.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Yes.
Hosh.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Lane.
No.
Lanning.
Aye.
Leibling.
No.
Loafer.
No.
Lomer.
Aye.
Mac.
Aye.
McDonald.
Aye.
McElfatrick.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Schumacher.
Yes.
Solwick.
No.
There being 12 ayes and 8 nays, we never have roll call votes here, Andy. The amendment, the motion prevails, and the bill is re-referred.
This is, I think, one of the best discussions we've had on this topic in some of those 14 years. I think this depth of content and good time to chat about it. So thank you, members, for that. Just before we get all up here, on Tuesday we're going to be looking at the forecast. We'll get the Hosh Liveness Project and maybe another bill or two. So have a great weekend. Drive safely. We're adjourned. Thank you, everybody.